Up next, a hairdresser is attacked in her own salon.
It's a male fist against a female face. Is it personal? Yeah, it was personal.
Only one of them got out alive.
It was the most frustrating case I have ever dealt with.
There is forensic evidence, but it doesn't match any of the suspects.
The fingerprint was never identified.
I really don't think that they're going to catch him.
The case goes cold until an auto mechanic comes forward with a secret.
There was something inside that said it still ain't right.
He's going to commit one of the most brutal murders in the history of Spartanburg County. For what reason? Why?
On a warm July night in 1995, a South Carolina woman was waiting for her ride home and witnessed a bizarre incident. She saw a man jump through the window of a hair salon and run away. The witness immediately called police.
The deputy arrived thinking, okay, I'm going to investigate a burglary at this beauty salon. Goes in and it's completely dark. He has a flashlight, training the beam of the flashlight around, walking, looking, seeing nothing.
But in the back room, he found a woman on the floor, murdered.
It had to be a very chilling discovery. The killer had used a strap, tied it around her neck, and then hung her from a hot water heater.
Robbery was not the motive. Her purse was left behind. There was money still in the cash register. Her car was left behind. It appeared that the motive probably was sexual related.
The victim was identified as 27-year-old Dana Satterfield, the owner of the hair salon. She was the mother of two young children.
She'd worked in the hair business for 7 years. I want to say she'd been in that shop 3 to 4. When I say shop, it was a converted mobile home that was made into a beauty salon.
The murder happened sometime around 8:30 when the shop was still open, although the logbook indicated no one was scheduled for an appointment.
I think that she would usually try to get out of there before it get dark, but it wasn't uncommon for her to work that late.
The witness, Diane Harris, described the man as white, about 5 feet 9 inches tall, and wearing jeans and a gray T-shirt.
She was very good on height. Obviously, race is important. You rule out a large segment of the population.
Based on the witness's facial description, a police artist created a composite sketch, which was distributed to the media. Another witness reported seeing a suspicious vehicle in the area.
He sees a blue and white Ford Bronco parked at a business. He notices this because he worked at this business himself. The business was closed, and he knew that vehicle probably shouldn't be there.
Inside the salon, police dusted for fingerprints, and they concentrated on the water heater where the killer strapped Dana's body.
It's a very smooth, hard finish, and powder will bring them up real clear, and you can lift them very easy off of a surface like that.
They found one print that was very clear.
There was a detective who said, whoever this print belongs to is definitely the killer. And I'm thinking, God, definitely is a strong word. How do you know that? And then he says the way the knot was tied, you had to put your hand there to do it.
In a surprising development, the print on the water heater matched Dana's estranged husband, Mike Satterfield. The couple, who had two young children, were recently separated.
All indications from the crime scene would be that the assailant knew Dana. It was angry and personal and vicious and vindictive.
Did Dana's husband have an alibi? Based on the evidence, investigators believe that the killer entered Dana Satterfield's hair salon shortly before closing, locked the door, turned out the lights, dragged her into the utility room where he strangled her to death.
To have a mother of two killed in this way, staged the way that her body was staged, left in that degraded state, the guys that I know that worked on the case, come hell or high water, they're gonna solve it.
At the autopsy, the medical examiner concluded the cause of death was strangulation, and a rape test kit found evidence of sexual assault.
Once they were able to generate a profile, that's when everyone started looking for a possible suspect.
Her body was the primary and best crime scene that we had, followed by the bathroom itself.
Investigators found a fingerprint on the water heater next to Dana's body. It belonged to Dana's estranged husband, Mike.
We had actually had a few problems, and she had actually been living a half a mile from here. The kids were staying here, and she was staying there.
When questioned by police, Mike claimed he was with his children at the time of the murder.
Because we were with him that night. Of course, when he got the phone call, we talked to her, and then he took us up there. So, I mean, I knew there's no way that my dad did it or had anything to do with it.
And there was a perfectly logical explanation for Mike's prints to be there. He did all the repair work.
I just put that water heater in there. I done all the maintenance up there. I took care of everything.
There's zero, nada, not one scintilla of evidence that Mike Satterfield had anything to do with this crime. None.
And it was clear that Mike Satterfield did not fit the description of the man the eyewitness saw jumping through the salon window.
He's an enormous man. With all due respect to him, he couldn't get out that window. There'd be a hole in the side of the mobile home if Mike tried to get out the window, and he'd tell you the same thing.
In a search for suspects, investigators found other fingerprints at the crime scene, one in Dana's blood. All were submitted to the statewide fingerprint database.
It has all the fingerprints of all the prisoners that's been arrested in South Carolina. And we take a picture of the fingerprint, bring it up on the computer screen.
Investigators were certain the bloody fingerprint would provide a lead. Unfortunately, there were no matches.
The fingerprint was never identified, and there's no telling how many they ran through, how many people they checked on that.
Investigators with strong backgrounds in working these type of crimes were brought in for this type of case.
The search for the white and blue Ford Bronco turned up plenty of possibilities.
And it's incredibly distinctive. Saw blade rims, blue and white Ford Bronco. It's not unique, but it's rare. I would think that was a pretty distinctive car, but apparently there are more of those than I would have imagined.
Police checked them all out, but all were dead ends.
Every single time me and my brother saw a Bronco pass by, we had to call it in. We had to tell my dad, Daddy, we saw a Bronco, you need to call.
As leads dwindled, the case gradually turned cold, and a year went by with no new developments. Then police got a break. A prison inmate told authorities that his cellmate, 29-year-old Russell Trevor Quinn, often spoke of Dana Satterfield.
It was something about how attractive Dana was. Believe it or not, lots of folks in prison try to swap information for a reduction in charges or less prison time, interestingly enough. And his cellmate didn't keep that confidence. He reported it to law enforcement.
Quinn was incarcerated for a crime that bore a marked similarity to Dana's murder.
He also was in prison for raping a woman and tying her to a tree.
Quinn was free at the time of Dana's murder and fit the eyewitness description of the killer.
The police got his mugshot, put it in a photo lineup, showed it to Diane Harris, as you will remember was our lone eyewitness. Diane actually picked Russell Trevor Quinn out of a photo lineup as being the person that she came in contact with. One of Dana's friends says, I've seen this man in the shop before. The police are able to put him in a car not dissimilar to the one seen near the scene.
But this turned out to be another dead end when his DNA didn't match the biological evidence from the crime scene.
Russell Trevor Quinn was a hopeful moment for the detectives. I mean, he's what you're looking for in terms of a suspect. He just didn't do it.
and the case went cold for the next 10 years. Until Dana Satterfield's daughter helped solve the case. There's no statute of limitations on murder cases, and they're never officially closed. But with each passing year, unsolved cases get more difficult to solve. That was true of the Dana Satterfield murder.
It was the most frustrating case I have ever dealt with.
For 10 years, Detectives Rick Gregory and Thomas Smith continued to work the case following potential leads.
I think most homicide investigators have a case that really sticks with them probably more than any other case.
There was two banker boxes full of leads, so there was an excess of 400 leads.
And the Satterfield family never gave up either.
You know, people would come up to me, Ashley, have they caught him yet? Have they heard anything? And I'm like, you know, I know that they're still working on the case, but I really don't think that they're going to catch him, because I really didn't think they would.
Ashley Satterfield was 8 years old when her mother was killed. Now she was 18, in college, and trying to move on with her life. One day, Ashley took her car in for repairs, and those repairs changed the course of the investigation.
Well, this girl came in with a little red Honda, and she got an oil change. And I was like, man, she was just in here a couple of weeks ago. And they said, yeah, that's Ashley Satterfield. And they said, well, you know Dana Satterfield that got murdered in Roebuck. Well, that's her daughter. I was like, her daughter? And yeah, I said, I didn't know she had kids.
This man, who wanted to remain anonymous, is an automobile mechanic. He knew something about Dana Satterfield's murder, or at least thought he did.
Just by seeing Ashley and her being her mother, I had to give them some closure.
10 years earlier, when the auto mechanic was in high school, his friend, Jonathan Vick, gave him a ride home. Vick was driving a white Ford Bronco with blue trim, like the one parked near the crime scene.
I'm gonna go get a haircut tonight. A haircut?
He said he's gonna go get his haircut. And I was like, where are you gonna get your haircut this time of night?
I'm gonna go see
Dana. He said, oh, we're at Dana's, and I never knew her last name.
So hot, man. I guess.
And Vic said he was interested in more than a haircut.
He would talk about how pretty she was and what he would like to do as far as sexual-wise and things like that.
I'm gonna ask her out. You're gonna ask her out on a date?
Yeah, so?
You serious?
Yes.
When I laughed at him, he got upset with me. He said, well, you don't think I have a chance? I just laughed. I was like, man, whatever.
Later, when he saw news reports about Dana Satterfield's murder, he wondered if Jonathan Vick was involved.
If you ask him, say he really didn't believe that he did it. Couldn't believe it. Wouldn't believe it. I mean, here's a 17-year-old with no record that you counted as one of your best friends. And he's going to commit one of the most brutal murders in the history of Spartanburg County? For what reason? Why?
Just after Dana's murder, this man claims he called police anonymously and told them about his conversation with Jonathan Vick. He also told them Vick was driving a white Ford Bronco. At the time, police questioned Jonathan Vick and his mother aggressively.
Investigators questioned her on 6 different occasions about the vehicle. You know, where was it that night? Who was using it? And the family was getting tired of people asking them, was this your Bronco here? Is this your vehicle? And they even went to the lengths of making a homemade sign that said, this is not the vehicle, and putting it on the Bronco as it traveled down the road. That's how many people were calling about it.
Police even tried to get a court order for Jonathan Vick's DNA. But the court refused on the grounds that driving a vehicle like the one seen near the crime scene was insufficient probable cause.
Now, where's the probable cause on Jonathan Vick at this time? It doesn't exist.
So police dropped their investigation of Jonathan Vick.
There was a time when I figured, well, maybe, you know, they have cleared him. But there was something inside that said it still ain't right. Something is just not right.
So now, 10 years later, this man Jonathan Vick's friend called police again, insisting that they investigate Vick for Dana Satterfield's murder. And just like before,
I didn't want to give my name.
But without his name, police couldn't get a court order to obtain Jonathan Vick's DNA sample. So police were right back where they started, and they had to wonder, what was this man really hiding? After waiting 10 long years, prosecutors now had a witness who claimed he knew what happened on the night of Dana Satterfield's murder. The witness said 17-year-old Jonathan Vick offered him a ride home from school. Vick said he was going to Dana's salon for a haircut. Vick also admitted he fantasized about Dana, a woman 10 years his senior, and said he planned to ask her out on a date. Vick entered Dana's salon around 8:30 p.m. It was almost closing time. Prosecutors believe Vick made a sexual advance and Dana refused. Perhaps she thought he was kidding. That's when Vick locked the door, turned out the lights, and attacked. In addition to sexual assault, he strangled her to death. For reasons no one can understand, he decided to leave through the window, which caught the attention of the witness, Diane Harris. She got a good look at him. The composite sketch from this brief encounter was remarkably accurate.
Pretty close to exactly what Jonathan Vick looks like. The hair, there was some issue as to whether the hair was light or dark. We had to go find some witnesses that said Vick used to tip his hair back then.
As to why Vick's prints weren't found in the salon, investigators say it happens more often than people think.
Just because someone touches something doesn't mean that that you have left a print. It has a lot to do with the amount of oil on your skin at the time, the surface that you're touching.
Eventually, the anonymous informant explained why he had waited all these years to come forward. He said Vick threatened to kill him if he ever told police what he knew about the murder.
No, he didn't tell me what he did. He said, if you tell anybody, I'll kill you. He knew that I knew that he was going over there.
He also realized 10 years later that he had a responsibility to the Satterfield family. So he gave police his name, Michael Pace.
And that does not keep me from being extraordinarily frustrated with him. But to his credit, he accepted responsibility. He was a very, very good witness.
And police got their court order for Vick's DNA sample.
Michael Pace is the probable cause that allowed us to get Jonathan Vick's DNA. Clearly, unequivocally, Michael Pace is how we got his DNA.
Jonathan Vick was still living in South Carolina after serving 2 years in the Marines.
I love my wife and daughter. That's all that matters.
He had had well over 15 different jobs, was getting fired or asked to leave because of his inability to get along with his coworkers or his supervisors.
Vick also had some brushes with the law.
He had two arrests. One was a domestic violence, which was dismissed, and there was a malicious injury, which is basically a vandalism, that was dismissed.
Now a husband and father of an infant daughter, Vick denied any involvement in Dana Satterfield's murder.
At the time of the arrest, he basically told us he never knew the woman.
Jonathan Vick's DNA matched the biological evidence from the rape test kit gathered at Dana's autopsy. A 900 million to 1 match.
I was relieved because that particular case had been sitting on my desk for 10 years. I was relieved that there was a match.
Every time you see a poster or see an article or watch TV or on the news or anything about the case, it bothered me. And now it's over with, I feel a lot better.
Investigators believe Dana Satterfield was Vick's first victim. Possibly not his last. There was another acquaintance of Jonathan Vick's, Heather Renee Sellers, who mysteriously disappeared. She's been missing for several years.
Miss Sellers was actually engaged to him only weeks prior to her disappearance.
Sellers' car was found at the bottom of a river. Her case is still open. In November of 2005, Jonathan Vick was convicted of Dana Satterfield's murder and sentenced to life in prison.
It was guilty, 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 all 12 guilty. I mean, they all knew it, yeah.
I'll never forget the words that he chose, because after all of this, there was still such an arrogance almost, or how can you accuse me, this innocent man that I am, how can they convict me of this?
Dana's murderer is still free, and I'm going to prison. She did not get justice today.
And then the judge said, you're going to prison for the rest of your life.
I have no sympathy for him or his mother or his wife or anyone in his family. I have no sympathy for none of them, because they all thought that, or still think that he's innocent. And they know that he's guilty. His mother knew that he was guilty. She knew. And she held back on that.
He's a pathological, maniacal liar, and I don't like him, but he received a fair trial.